Start with little Rilke. I live my life in growing orbits, which move out over the things of this world. Perhaps I can never achieve the last, but that will be my attempt. I am circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I have been circling for 1,000 years, and I still don't know if I'm a falcon or a storm or a great song. It's just an excerpt, I think, of a longer poem. I live my life in growing orbits and move out over the things of this world. Perhaps I can never achieve the last, but that will be my attempt. I am circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I have been circling for 1,000 years, and I still don't know if I'm a falcon or a storm or a great song. Still don't know. And then some words from His Holiness, Dalai Lama. It's a very wonderful, practical book about the Heart Sutra. It's called Essence of the Heart Sutra, is one of the three that I suggested on the website there. And any one of these is enough. You don't have to feel like you're missing out on something, because how could you be missing out on anything? Right? The Heart Sutra doesn't seem to allow that lack. So the Dalai Lama said, this was a series of teachings that he gave that they turned into a book. These Dharma teachers that write a gazillion books, they don't actually write any books. They just give a lot of talks and have really devoted students that transcribe and edit. Actually, Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, does write a few books, but then the other 300 were done by his students. So Dalai Lama said, destructive acts are motivated by disturbed states of mind. That is to say, by a mind that's dominated by the afflictions. In the entire history of human society, it is these mental afflictions, these undisciplined states of mind, that underlie humanity's destructive acts, from the smallest act of killing a fly to the greatest atrocities of war. We must remember that ignorance itself is an affliction. For example, when we fail to grasp the negative long-term consequences of an action, and we instead act out of short-sighted thoughts of gain. So ignorance itself is affliction. For example, it is an example of ignorance when we fail to grasp the negative long-term consequences of an action and act out of short-sighted thoughts of gain. If we closely examine the feeling of strong desire or strong anger, we'll find that at the root of these emotions lies grasping at the object of the emotions. So let's pause a moment. So imagine last time you had a strong desire, sometime today probably, strong desire. So what does that feel like? So he's saying there's some element of grasping and an object. And if we take it still further, we discover that at the root of all this lies grasping at our sense of self. Not recognizing the emptiness of self and other, we mistakenly grasp at both as if they were autonomous, objectively real, and independently existent. As the 8th century philosopher Chandrakirti points out in his Guide to the Middle Way, we first grasp at the sense of self, and then we extend this grasping onto others. First you have a sense of I, then you grasp at things as mine. By looking into our own minds, we can see that the stronger the grasping is, the more forcefully it generates negative and destructive emotions. There is a very intimate causal connection between grasping at a sense of self and the arising of destructive emotions within us. As long as we remain under the dominion of this erroneous belief, we'll have no room for lasting joy. This is what it means to be imprisoned in the cycle of existence. Suffering is nothing but existence enslaved to ignorance. And I think destructive emotion sounds a little dramatic, you know. But this, he means, you know, all grasping, you know, all sort of, all, even more subtle and quieter senses of being a little out of phase or a little grouchy or a little grumpy or a little wanting things to be different from what they are. These are all destructive emotions. So it's not just like killing people. So we all have this. Although there are many afflictions and many ways of classifying them, three in particular, attachment, anger, and delusion, are always referred to as the three poisons of the mind. Just as poison causes harm to the body and physical suffering, and can even bring one's life to an end, these mental afflictions also cause misery, perhaps even hastening our death. Ultimately, mental afflictions not only cause suffering to ourselves and others, but they also obstruct our attainment of happiness. In this sense, the internal states are our enemy. These internal enemies are even more pernicious than any external enemy ever could be. Even though we might at least stand a chance of hiding, we could hide from an external enemy. No matter where we go, mental afflictions can arise. You can't hide. Furthermore, the internal enemy remains our enemy always. There's not even the slightest chance that our internal enemy will become our friend at some point in the future. That's interesting, interesting attitude. There's no place in which we can escape this internal enemy, no way to win the enemy over to our side, and no way this enemy will cease its attack. So what can we do? We can understand emptiness. Huh. Did you think that was coming next? By understanding emptiness, by clearly penetrating the empty nature of all phenomena, including ourselves, we can liberate ourselves from negative emotions and thus from the creation of unwholesome karma and the power of the internal enemy. Through this process, we begin to undo the harm we've caused by our grasping and the derivative strong emotions to which it gives rise. The moment we begin to develop insight into the empty nature of self and all reality, the process of releasing our deluded grasp begins. At the moment of our first insight into the empty nature of self and reality, we start to break free of the enslavement of ignorance and the attack of the internal enemy. By reducing our grasping, we start to undo the causal chain of unenlightened existence. By undermining self-grasping ignorance, the first link of dependent origination, you prevent the arising of the second link and ultimately become free of the endless cycle of suffering lifetimes. So he's referring to a particular teaching about one thing leads to another internally. What does all this mean exactly? If we arrive at the knowledge that the self at which we grasp is empty, we may imagine this means that we as individuals with personal identities will stop existing, but of course that's not the case. Our own personal experiences demonstrate that as subjects and agents of our own life, subject and agents of our own lives, we certainly do exist. So how then do we understand the content of this insight into the absence of self? What follows from this insight? We must be very clear that only the self that is being grasped as real needs to be negated. The self as a conventional phenomena is not rejected. This is a crucial aspect of the Buddha's teachings on emptiness. Without understanding this distinction, one cannot fully understand the meaning of not-self. Later on, we'll get more deeply into the discussion of the Heart Sutra, and I'll elaborate on this point in greater detail. So, it's the Dalai Lama. So we focus on, one part of what he's saying there, I think it's really relevant to us, you know, is that what he's saying is we're kind of looking in the wrong direction, right, at these internal processes. We're noticing that we're angry and we're upset about that. We're noticing that we're desiring something strongly and we're embarrassed or upset about that. But he's saying, well, that's not really what's important. What's important is what led to that. So that in Buddhism, there's this huge emphasis on sort of peeling back the causes and conditions of things. What's under that? What's under that? So to become sensitive to this more subtle sense of grasping or pushing away, right? And so then we're back to the skandhas. And we're back especially to the second skandha, the skandha of Vedana. So have you taken up the suggestion to try to unpack the skandhas a little bit in your daily living? What are you finding so far? We talked about the five skandhas, the body, form in the world, Vedana. I have a new translation for Vedana, which is leanings. It's kind of what it is. It's leanings. Leaning into things, leaning out of things. And we can sort of, you know, right away you can kind of feel, well, no wonder we're off balance, right? We're always sort of leaning. So, form, leanings, Vedana, perceptions, you know, like paying more attention to what is the actual act of perception actually feel like? What is it really like to really see, to really listen, to really hear, to really feel, really taste? And then we have the sort of complicated catch-all one, samskara, which I think maybe we should say thinking, so we don't get too into technical sort of abhidharmic sort of stuff. Thinking. So to actually look at thinking as an experience, not as me, right? Not as me. Do we impute some sort of meanness onto our thinking, or can we just experience thinking? And then the subtle one is consciousness. You know, what is it that can actually perceive these things? How is it that when the eyes take in sensory data and it's processed somehow in the brain or something, we have an experience of seeing? So that's a consciousness. And then it's also a kind of a consciousness in Buddhist psychology that can cognize that there is a thought, which is kind of strange if you think about it. I mean, the very experience which everyone has in everyday life, that sometimes you're caught in your thinking, and sometimes you notice your thinking. Well, who's noticing? Who's noticing the thinking? And so if you are your thinking, then who's this other guy? How many people are in there, you know? How many people are in there? So what have you noticed about the study of skandhas in everyday life? Anybody have any comments? Nancy? So I had a dream. I wrote some notes on the internet. Maybe some of you read this, but probably not everybody. And then once I came to look at my notes, they were pretty garbled, and it's a wonder anyone made sense of them, so I tried to clean it up a little bit. So I had a dream that somehow seems to connect all this Heart Sutra business. In a dream, I met a man, another man, a stranger, by coincidence. I was on the side of the road trying to fix a flat tire on my bike, but the hole was too big, and I couldn't fix it. And the man I met was somehow saying hello, and because he had the same kind of bike. And so we were talking about that kind of bike, and what a coincidence that was. Like maybe it was an unusual kind of bike or something. And as we got to talking in the dream, it became clear that this man, my new friend, just held lots of similar attitudes about life. And we're just feeling more and more of a sense of affinity and connection. The man, and this is like some strange dream details, but that's what happened. He mentioned that he had recently purchased a vacation house on Samish Island, you know, where we do our retreats. But he was really upset because somehow his purchasing of this vacation house had upset another friend of his. And he was feeling great regret about that, the same way, you know, I would feel. And so we seemed to have so much in common, you know, gender, attitudes, you know, taste in possessions, values about friendship. And then I was thinking that feeling like this feeling of affinity in the dream was somehow a deeper thing than just a sum of similarities, than a sort of, you know, aggregate and a skandha in some way. A sense of really belonging together, almost as if this other person was just sort of an emanation of me, which I suppose is my dream, so he was. But you know what I mean. That affinity is sort of not just overlap or something like that, not just a practical thing, like, you remember Venn diagrams from math, you know? It's not just the amount of, like, oh, I don't like this person, oh, I like this person. And then I was remembering after I woke up that in Robert Aiken Roshi's essay about the short chant we do in Meijuku Kanon-gyo, which is a chant for Kanon, which is the Japanese name for Guanyin, which is Avalokiteshvara, so this is the interlocutor in our sutra. So we have this short sutra about Kanon, so about the Bodhisattva of compassion. And one of the most repeated word in that sutra is nen. You know that part? Cho nen kanze an bo nen kanze an nen 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 ju shin ki nen ne fu ri shin. So all these nens in there. So that word, that nen, is the Japanese or the Chinese character for affinity, for connection. And so this, our chant that brings up compassion, brings up something about, you know, affinity, about this feeling of being in harmony or being in a sort of intimate relationship with somebody or something or all things. And the character, so now let's do a little bit of Chinese. I don't know if this is really important or anything, but it's where the Heart Sutra came from. The Heart Sutra is 260 Chinese characters. May or may not ever have even existed in Sanskrit, so since I took a little bit of calligraphy class, we might as well enjoy that. So remember, this is Heart Sutra. So this top one is the character for heart. And remember, in Asian languages, heart and mind is one construct, and the bottom one is sutra. And I'm just making this up, but actually, you know, the word for sutra has the same root as a suture, so it's like stitching things together. And I was just noticing that this character kind of looks like something stitched together, doesn't it? But I'm just making that up. So then the character Nen, though, this character for affinity that's so important in the way we revere compassion, here's Nen, it has the character for heart at the bottom. It's the radical of the character is heart. So that's Nen in Japanese. A beautiful little character, yeah. And so this character, it also is used to mean attention, desire, thought. So they use these characters in a lot of different ways, and often with combined with other characters to make different meanings. Also wishes. So a kind of a wish or a thought or a desire to connect is the meaning of Nen. Or maybe the result of that, the actuality of connection and wishfulness and attending is Nen. So maybe it kind of means sort of like the deep yearning for connection, which is kind of our deepest thing, isn't it? I mean, that's, in some level, why we suffer. This sort of sense of separation, isolation, this self that can't be happy in Hawaii, you know? The separateness, you know? And then when I was looking the character up in the dictionary, I saw that it's used in a Buddhist term, unen. Unen. So here's unen. We take nen, and we put the character for no on top, which is mu, which is the same famous mu from the koan, right? And many of our Zen brothers and sisters spend many years of their lives working with this character, mu, which means no or not or negate. But it also has a sense, just like paramita, is a sense of going beyond. So this construct, when you put mu and nen together, it would, on the face of it, seem to mean a lack of affinity, right? It seems, from a Western point of view, it seems to mean no affinity. That's bad. But actually, the Buddhist term, unen, means total liberation. Total liberation. Total freedom. Freedom from obstructive thoughts. So it's a lack of anything that prevents this, is what it kind of means. So that's pretty interesting. I didn't know about unen. So freedom from what blocks us, which in a way is freedom, makes sense, because how are we going to find connection and affinity with each other in the world? By sort of grasping for it? No. By letting it go, right? By letting it go, or realizing in some way that it was already there to begin with. Like Nancy talking about the brain and desire and addictions, Norman has this teaching that I've always sort of, I don't know if it really makes sense to me, but Norman has this teaching that the moment a desire arises, it's already fulfilled. It's just your confusion about desire that you think you have to do something to fulfill the desire. Actually, if you understand the desire in a certain way, and it's in this way, and you realize, oh, the desire is complete. It comes and it goes. There's no need to do anything. And so I was thinking about my dream, where, you know, the vehicle to connection with my new friend was the skandhas. You know, my bike, a thing, a physical thing, rupa, and my preference for that type of bike, our different attitudes and thoughts and perceptions. And so it's not like the Heart Sutra is saying, you know, forget about all that. Just blank out. You know, just do a lot of meditation. It seems to be saying that our very confusion, you know, our very desire, our very anger is the road into affinity somehow. So that when Avalokiteshvara looks deeply into her moment-by-moment experience, and she sees everything that's arising is empty, and so we understand that to mean empty of any separation, she's not saying that she rejects her experience. She's saying it's through the skandhas, through my study of my actual life, right? So this is not, like sometimes we have this term spiritual, right? Which is a Western term. There's not an equivalent term in Buddhism. Like spiritual is different from, you know, mundane or something like that. So, you know, reality is spiritual, and spiritual is reality. Ordinary experience is the entry point. And so now let's continue with the sutra, finally. I mean, if we're lucky, by the end of the practice period, we'll get, you know, halfway through. So we did the title, and we did the first line. But now we have the real crux of the matter. So if you want, if you're the kind of person that likes to look at the text, it's on page, what? Five. Well, it's just a teeny little text, right? Teeny little text. It's somehow this teeny little text, and now I've studied it, you know, a couple of times now, and the last time I ran into my notes and I was remembering, I had forgotten actually, that the last time I did a class on the Heart Sutra was when I was at Shuso. I was the first Shuso in Bellingham in 2004. And I didn't read my old notes. It would be interesting to see what I said then. And I was talking to somebody about this a little earlier. Is somehow this short sutra, it's not exactly that we have to understand what it means, but somehow the chanting of it and how deeply it's embedded in the tradition and the stories about it and the stories of the people who brought it forward and have commented on it. You know, they did all the effort to make this big book out of the Dalai Lama's seminar. Something about the sutra encourages a process of investigation. So someone was asking me, does it matter if we understand the sutra? I don't know, you know. Well, it depends on what you mean by understanding, I guess. But if it encourages us to take a fresh look at our lives, then there's something really deep and valuable there. Because we all know very well that our habitual thoughts and attitudes about our life are not quite right, right? There's something a little bit off about this idea of who we are and what we think we know, right? So that's emptiness, right? Letting go, emptying out, being free from our limited view of our life. And somehow this strange little tale about Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra, and maybe next week we'll finally chant the whole thing together in this little frame story, the Buddha's in the background kind of encouraging them to investigate their lives. Somehow it brings us forward into our life in a certain way, and maybe it's just because it's short enough to memorize. So anyway, Avalokiteshvara was practicing wisdom that goes beyond Prajnaparamita, and she saw that all five aggregates, the skandhas, are empty of separateness and was relieved of all suffering. So now the second paragraph is her, she's explaining how this works. So those are the most famous lines probably in all of Mahayana Buddhism. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So the first thing to notice about this little paragraph is that, and this whole sutra in general, it's incredibly condensed, right? It's incredibly condensed so that we can memorize and chant it and carry it forward. And so this last sentence is really important. The last sentence is saying that I just use form as an example. You can apply the same whole formula to the other skandhas. And oddly, our current translation has sensations as the translation for Vedana, which I didn't really notice until last week. Like, that's kind of weird, you know. So anyway, we know what they mean. So we can apply this whole thing and just replace the word form with, let's say, leanings, maybe. So leanings, so Vedana leanings, do not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from these leanings, from these preferences. Leanings themselves are emptiness. Emptiness themselves itself is leanings, or is perception, or is thought. So then we think, well, okay, but it still doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Is it helpful? And so I was thinking about this and thinking, well, what is really meant here by emptiness? And we've talked about this a little bit before. Emptiness is a negative word, right? A word of negation, a lack of something. And so if something is lacking, what happens there? What happens is when something is lacking, everything else can come forward. So what's lacking is a sort of an obstruction, a lack of obstructions or a lack of boundaries, right? A lack of boundaries is here. Like the way in our culture we hate to say no, right? I know I do. Do you like to say no? I hate to say no. But then you realize, you know, as you practice saying no, we should have a saying no retreat, you know. You just practice, you know.
No.
Yeah, exactly. But then you realize, you know, if you can say no to something in a clear way, actually what you're doing is saying yes to everything else. You know, saying no is deeply saying yes, you know, saying yes to everything. And so we could replace emptiness with something that is more like inviting everything in, because it's empty of separation, right? What we're empty of here is empty of separation. So let's use boundlessness. Let's use boundlessness. And let's use, how about thought? So we can play with the wording here to make it helpful to us and rewrite the sutra, because, you know, it's translated anyway. So how about boundlessness and thought? So thought does not differ from boundlessness. Boundlessness does not differ from thought. I'm like, what? Thought itself is boundless. Boundlessness itself is thought. So can you feel that? It has a different feeling, doesn't it? Form is emptiness. And thought itself is boundless. So, like, thought is the entryway, right? Because that's what we have, right? We're conceptual people. We're conceptual beings. You know, we have this sense kind of in the corner of our eye or in the edge of our thinking, or when we're grounded sometimes, once in a while in meditation, you know, Kate's story. You know, the sense that there's more to it than thought. We know that, but thought is what's to hand, right? So can we follow thought through to boundlessness, to emptiness, to, you know, beyond thought? And so that's why we can watch, that's the value of watching thought come and go. Thought itself is boundlessness. So this is greatly liberating, right? Because, you know, we don't like our thinking very much. And you can study Vedana, and study, like, that sense of positive and negative, with thoughts arising, like, oh, we don't like our thinking very much. But maybe we can turn our thinking about thinking around a little bit. Is there a way that our thinking itself is liberation? So our ordinary life is liberation. So this is kind of interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So yeah, we could say thought itself is liberation. Wow, you know. So we can study that, and how would that feel to allow? And so what liberation or freedom is like freedom from being bound, right? Freedom from being constrained or fixed in a position, right? Like we suffer because we're fixed in a certain position. You know, we think I'm this kind of person and I'm limited, right? I'm suffering because I'm fixed. So another way to say emptiness might be, you know, fluid, right? Not fixed, completely fluid. So maybe the nature of thought is not so fixed and separate as we think it is. Maybe there's a fluidity and an openness there, which we don't see because of a habit of mind. So it's all kind of surprising, because when we're coming from a fixed position, we would like to be in another position, right? Right? Because if you have one position, it stands in contrast to a better position. The grass is always greener by definition, right? That's the way, the nature of the grass. It's greener over there because we're over here. And so the emptiness of self that Dalai Lama is talking about, to see this, the release from this ignorance, is liberating, because we can take a break from this need to negate our current position and get to another position, because our current position is already that position, right? Our current position isn't a position. There's no position. So our position is empty of positionness, is another way to say this. So if you talk about it too much, it just gets confusing. The thing to do is just breathe. And you could take up a phrase like this and breathe with it in your home practice. Like, maybe do your own re-scrambling of this formula, whatever seems helpful to you. You know, where do you feel caught or bound, you know? And maybe play with that, you know, like, you know, what's your most troublesome quality, you know, like arrogance or something like that. Arrogance does not differ from boundlessness. So what is the boundlessness that arises with arrogance? You know, what is that? What is that freedom? And so all this is also kind of a deep expression of the sort of non-dual teachings of Zen, right? So that's why this is chanted so much in Zen. The Zen is interested in the way language and conceptual life creates, you know, opposition of things, right? And it just does it naturally, right? The minute you can't, like positional words are this way, right? There couldn't be a short unless there was a tall, right? And there couldn't be a tall unless there was a short. But does tall really mean anything? What if everyone was the same size and there's no tall, right? And there's no short. So language creates these divisions and it gets internalized. It's kind of the ideal of all this. And the Mahayana emptiness teachings are saying, well, are you sure? Are you so sure? Is there another way to feel your life that's not bound by separation in that way? And the beauty of this is that the path is really and truly right in front of us. The path is really truly right in front of us, and it's really truly right now. So it's not like we're going to improve ourselves so that later we can walk the path. The path is actually an entry into our actual experienced life with the supportive teachings to help us see that in a little different way than we habitually do. And so even... So that's where I think in Zen we use a little different language from Dalai Lama when he talks about enemies. I mean, it's beautiful what he says about enemies, and it's skillful, I think. But, of course, our enemies are also our friends, right? Our enemies are also our friends. And so it's a little bit like this poem, which I maybe quote a little too much. It's popular in the mindfulness movement. The Guest House by Rumi. It's a little bit like that. This radical allowing of our experience to be our experience. This being human is a guest house. Every moment, every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Have you heard that poem before? Yeah. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So that's a nice poem, but really the practice here is in the doing of this, right? The actual doing of this. And it's hard to even know when we're not doing this because of our, you know, the power of our habitual reactivity and the way we fix ourselves and the reality with conceptual thinking is so strong, right? So strong that we think it's just a matter of course to reject some part of ourself, right? To reject some part of ourself seems natural, maybe even healthy. But maybe there are different ways to live our life. And for some reason I was writing a list that made me think of Walt Whitman. Maybe better just to read poems and not try to explain the Heart Sutra. And so I have a home practice suggestion for you, which is actually read the Song of Myself to your out loud, the whole thing. The whole thing, yeah. It gets excerpted like crazy because it has so many wonderful little things, but then the rest of it gets left on the cutting room floor, right? So here, I'll just read you. This is section 51 towards the end. But it's a nice practice just to read out loud. It didn't take that long, you know, 10 minutes. But of course, in our hurry-up culture, it seems like forever. So that's a good practice. So here's section 51, where he actually kind of uses the terminology of emptiness. Listen to this. How did, you know, was it just not really just Buddhism, maybe? The past and present wilt. I have filled them, emptied them, and proceed to fill my next fold of the future. Listener, up there, what have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly. No one else hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. I concentrate toward them that are nigh. I wait on the door slab. Who has done this day's work? Who will soonest be through with his supper? Who wishes to walk with me? Will you speak before I am gone? Will you prove already too late? The past and present wilt, I have filled them and emptied them, and proceed to fill my next fold of the future. Listener, up there, what have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly, no one else hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes. I concentrate toward them that are nigh, I wait on the door slab. Who has done his day's work? Who will soonest be through with his supper? Who wishes to walk with me? Will you speak before I am gone? Will you prove already too late? So somehow, what this Heart Sutra is trying to get at shows up in all kinds of places. So I have a few suggestions for you for this coming week. One is, even though the Heart Sutra is sort of this densely packed text full of references to core Buddhist teachings, it's also a sort of a mantra, you know, and it ends with what it calls a mantra. And I don't know if we'll get that far in the seminar, but it's kind of a strange, at first it seems like a very strange text because the first, actually it's two pages in our book. The first page is sort of very sort of systematic and it goes through things and explains things and Avalokiteshvara is talking to Shariputra. And then the second to last paragraph here on page 6, and then after all this explanation and enthusiasm about these teachings, it says, therefore, it's a mantra. Right? So therefore, it's a mantra. And then we have at the very end the famous mantra, gate gate, paragate, parasangate bodhisvaha. But we don't usually actually chant the mantra. Have you noticed that? We're devoted to this text that says the best possible thing is that there's this mantra. We chant the whole text, so maybe the whole text is kind of a mantra. But my suggestion is, why don't you try in your home practice actually chanting the mantra? Actually chanting the mantra. And you could do that, you know, a formal kind of practice situation at home, maybe making offerings at an altar, and then chant the mantra like maybe 21 times. you could figure out a simple way to count it with a little mala, or just chant it for a couple of minutes. I mean, it doesn't matter how many times. Just, you know, out loud, you know, gate, gate, pa, however you want to chant it, gate, gate, para, gate, parasam, gate, bodhisattva, gate. And to see, you know, what does that feel? What does it actually feel like, you know? What does it actually feel like? You can try chanting, and you could try chanting the mantra when you're walking around, or waiting for the bus, or any time, you know. So that's one suggestion for home practice. It's Sanskrit. More or less. I don't know if they'd pronounce it the way we're pronouncing it. Yeah, it's Sanskrit. And interestingly, when it was translated to Chinese, they didn't try to use characters with the meaning of those words. They used characters that sound like those words. So they transliterated it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we have now in our chant book, the Japanese version of that sounds slightly different, right? It's yate. Gyate, gyate, hara, gyate, haraso, gyate, boji, soaka. Yeah, a little bit different. Not too much. So that's one suggestion. Play with the mantra. Another suggestion is, just trying to make sense of my suggestion here. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Another suggestion is, and this might be a good thing to work with, use a journal maybe, or maybe just noticing. Maybe just reflecting in bed at the end of the day, or as it's happening. Notice trouble. Notice trouble. Troublesome emotions, right? Desire, aversion, anger, annoyance. And, you know, be sensitive. Sometimes they're small, you know, because the background noise is loud, you know. Notice trouble. And see if you can contemplate, you know, how could this trouble actually be boundless? How could this trouble be like a Dharma gate to enter more deeply into our life, to transform our life? You know, that our first impulse is so often to try to minimize trouble, or, you know, sort of steer clear of it, or explain it, rationalize it. See if we can sort of really experience trouble, you know, troublesome experiences, emotions, reactivity, and see if we can sort of feel our way into how could this be, you know, Buddha? How could this trouble be Buddha? How could it be this unin, this affinity beyond affinity for our life? So, you know, just play with it, see what happens. Or keep studying the skandhas, or just sitting, or reading the commentaries, or whatever the heck you're doing. But, you know, it's practice period, so we have a little shared opportunity here maybe to take things up in a certain way. And these things are not always big, grand, exciting projects, you know. Sometimes people do have big experiences, and if they have a big enough experience, they can write a best-selling book. That's nice, but, you know. But most of the time, these things are very small experiences, but small is big, you know. Small is big, right? That's the other nature of these teachings. Small is big, and big is small. Like they say in some of the Zen poems, just a hair's breadth deviation. That's how far off we are from the true reality of liberation. Just a hair off. So it's just a little... And then we're circling around God, and we don't even know if we're a falcon or a storm or a great song, and it's okay. It's wonderful that we don't know, right? The fixed self kind of needs to know which one it is, right? So this is the boundless self. Okay, that's enough for now, I think.